Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. As the United States prepares to build its first new nuclear power reactors in three decades, concerns about new plants have resurfaced since the disaster in Fukushima, Japan. Utah is not immune. This January, the state engineer decided to award the Green River Nuclear Power Plant the massive amount of water they need for operations. Joining us on the program today are a husband and wife team who are determined to make a difference through film.
My name is Don Argott. The film is The Atomic States of America.
Sheena Joyce, also with The Atomic States of America.
Atomic States of America premiered at the Sundance Film Festival this year in Park City.
It's always fun to see your film in front of an audience for the first time. You lose perspective on it when you're, you know, locked in an edit room for a while and you're just seeing it among your little production team. It's always fun to see what people are surprised by, what they laugh at, if it's what you think will happen. I think generally we've been really well received. We had packed theaters, we had excellent Q&As, and overall we're pretty pleased.
Yeah. Absolutely. No, it's like Sheena said, you know, you spend so long working on these films and you, after 2 years, like your eyes kind of glaze over. You can't look at it anymore. But the one thing that is always invigorating is to see it with a group of people for the first time, because we can never see it that way again. And so it gives us a little bit of context of like, wow, okay, we made some of the right decisions in this and people are laughing at the right spots and they're responding in spots that we hope that they would. So it's cool.
The film is inspired by the book by Kelly McMasters called Welcome to Shirley, a memoir from an atomic town.
I think from start to finish, the film took about 2 years. We were given the book by our manager, who's an executive producer on the film, Danny Sherman, when we were at the Toronto Film Festival with our last film called The Art of the Steel. And Don and I read the book and fell in love with it in Kelly's voice. And it happened at a time when we were hearing about the nuclear renaissance and the federal loan guarantees to restart our nuclear fleet. So we thought the time was perfect to explore the issue and talk to people on both sides and go to reactor communities. So there were a lot of interviews and a lot of research. And what do you say, Don? It was about 2 years start to finish?
About 2 years. And then within the first year of filming, March 11th happened and basically changed our entire film and changed the lives of the characters in our film as well. So, I mean, we really feel fortunate that we were on the front lines of this issue, because we, any film that comes out at this point, if they weren't filming before March 11th, it's going to be a post-Fukushima world. And we had a pre-Fukushima world and a post-Fukushima world in our film. And I think that's a really valuable thing to see how people responded before the disaster and now clearly how that's shaped some of the changes that are occurring around the world.
How did it change the film? In what ways specifically?
It reframed the film because it reframed the dialogue in this country about nuclear energy, and it certainly changed the lives of the people that we were following. They had a new call to action, some of the advocates in the community. And I think the people who were pro-nuclear needed to take this incident and learn from it and examine how lessons learned in Japan would affect nuclear here in the U.S.
Yeah, I agree with that.
There are these, you call them unintentional activists.
Yes.
Can you explain that?
Sure. We were very careful to not make... It was not our intention to make a propaganda piece or an activist piece. We really wanted to just ask some tough questions and explore both sides of the issue. We went into these reactor communities and spoke to the people living in them and people who also were asking tough questions in their communities of their local government, of our federal government, of the NRC. And these are people that are not necessarily politically active, that don't fall, you know, on the right or the left, you know, as a blanket statement. So they were affected by the reactors in their community. They were generally negatively affected by the reactors in their community, whether it be leaks or illnesses, and became unintentional activists. I think they don't want to be labeled as activists, but rather as community advocates. And I think that's how they're portrayed, and certainly how we see them in the film.
Yeah, and that was a very important thing, that because we did speak to a lot of people on the anti-nuclear side, and we spoke to a lot of people on the pro-nuclear side. And I think that, you know, there is a film to be made you know, and the other documentaries that I've seen, from Three Mile Island to Chernobyl, and some like pretty scary propaganda type pieces from pro-nuclear people and also anti-nuclear people. This to us was important to not be that. We didn't want to be this polarizing, this polarizing film that would be easily discounted and discredited. And I think a lot of times, specifically with documentaries that have a left leaning message, like a Michael Moore, he automatically gets discounted as, oh, he's just a left-wing propagandist, and he's just trying to, like, you know, kind of get his message out there, and he's not really concerned with a lot of facts here and there, and so he cherry picks information and things like that. So we didn't want to fall within that that line of being a propaganda film. And frankly, one of the most powerful things that happened to us during the screening on Tuesday is two people had come up to us after the screening, and one guy said he was a pro-nuclear guy. He came up, self-proclaimed pro-nuclear guy, and he came up to me afterwards. He said, "I really thought I was going to come in here and be very angry, but I have to tell you, you did such an amazing job of laying it out perfectly in ways that people can understand and in ways that weren't inflammatory, and you did it all right." And I thought, like, wow, that's a pretty big compliment coming from somebody who, you know, is a pro-nuclear person, because we didn't want it to be an anti-nuclear piece.
Right. And so what do you want viewers to get from it? What do you hope that they walk away with?
I hope viewers are ready to ask more questions and to start an intelligent dialogue about whether or not man can responsibly split the atom. Whether you think it's safe, whether you think it's clean and green, doesn't affect the fact that we have not figured out what to do with the waste. And I think before we restart this nuclear fleet, before we, you know, celebrate the nuclear renaissance, perhaps we should examine how we've gotten here and what we've been left with, and figure out what to do with it first.
And can you talk about death row? And what, hearing the cancer statistics was just devastating to me, especially with the children.
I mean, I think that the tough thing about nuclear and radiation is that it's very hard to prove. And I think that the pro-nuclear side has always stood behind that statistic of, well, oh, well, you get cancer. What's your lifestyle? Did you smoke? What kind of foods do you eat? And, you know, to us, it was less about, you know, because clearly it's hard to prove, but more importantly, there is circumstantial evidence that if 1 in 4 million kids get a rare childhood cancer called rhabdomyosarcoma, and it hits 1 in 4 million kids every year, and there is 27 in one area, you know, when at a certain point you have to say, like, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. If it's caused by low-level radiation, where could this low-level radiation be coming from? You know what I mean? So it's like, those are the kinds of things that I feel like the industry constantly hides behind. They always say, well, nobody died as a result of Three Mile Island, and only a few people have died at Chernobyl. And, you know, now Fukushima is going to be the next thing that, oh, no one died immediately. And so, but the thing is that radiogenic cancers take very, very long to develop. And so cancers, you know, it's almost like, you know, I don't mean to make light of it, but it sounds like the perfect crime. I mean, if you get exposed to radiation and then 15 years later you get cancer, you're probably not going to blame it on the place you grew up. The doctor's probably going to ask you, well, did you smoke? What kind of foods did you eat? You're probably predisposed to get cancer. That very few doctors ever ask, it seems, where do you live? You know, what are you around? What's your surroundings? And I think, you know, there is an environmental impact that from, you know, places like nuclear plants and coal plants and things like that. But, you know, they're not, for some reason, it's always, that's the last question, if it's even asked at all, I feel.
It's very hard to directly prove a link. But as Don said, circumstantial evidence piles up.
What has been the reaction from Brookhaven about the film?
Brookhaven National Lab was, if not the first, one of the first phone calls I made. And I tried speaking to the company that you know, runs it. And I tried speaking to the Department of Energy, and was repeatedly denied access and denied interviews. So I'm not sure what their reaction will be. You can take a look at what their reaction to Kelly's book was and imagine what it will be. But we certainly were not trying to be inflammatory. We were trying to tell a story about, you know, what really happened. And there's no denying what had happened at Brookhaven for so many years. The NRC has not seen the film, but they were extremely cooperative. We tried really, really hard to present their case and give them a fair shake. We'll let the viewer decide what they think. I'm interested in what they think of the film. You know, but again, we just keep saying the same thing. When Don and I started out, we really wanted to present both sides and make sure that the NRC had a voice in this. And they were incredibly welcoming and gave us great access. And we believe we treated them fairly.
I'm really proud of how the NRC is portrayed, because I do think that at the heart of it, they are really good people. And I don't feel that they are trying to harm anyone. I believe that they are trying to keep these plants safe, and for the most part they do a pretty good job of it. But I also think that their hands are tied, because, you know, they don't write the rules. Congress writes the rules. And I think therein lies, I think, the real problem, because, you know, Congress is run by lobbyists, you know, and the nuclear lobby is, so it's like the industry's
fox guarding the hen house,
you know. And I think that there is really, really good people that work at the NRC, and we've met some of them, and they're really nice people. And I really believe that they are doing the best job that they can, but I also feel like they have limitations to how much they can do. And there is a culture of, you know, how, you know, we profile in the film a whistleblower, somebody who basically was working at a nuclear power plant and spoke up against some of the things that were going on at Millstone, and he got fired. And then, so, you know, that's there's a culture of that too. It's like, don't rock the boat, you know. And I'm sure that's runs rampant in any industry, but, you know, it's scary when it's the nuclear industry, and you would hope that they're a little more regulated and more kind of safeguarded than, you know, some other industries that are less dangerous.
I think there are a lot of people who live in these communities that assumed that there was a government agency, whether that be a state or a federal agency or regulator, that had their best interest at heart and was looking out for them. And I think they thought when something went wrong that they would be answered honestly and be made whole. And I believe that these communities don't think they will ever be made whole again.
Part of that mistrust stems from disease clusters in areas near the reactors. There are particularly high rates of breast cancer on Long Island.
I believe on Long Island, it's something like 1 in 7 now. And there's a news clip in the film from the late 80s, which is 1 in 9. I think there's no denying that there are increases, particularly on Long Island, in soft tissue cancer, in breast cancer, thyroid, lung cancer. I think as our world gets more complex, we really need to look at these numbers and look at these issues and see if we can find a correlation between what's going on environmentally and what's going on health-wise in our lives. And the National Academy of Science is embarking on a study to see if it's even feasible to trace health effects to proximity to nuclear reactors. So I believe that's still in the feasibility stage.
Yeah. And, you know, that's the thing. I feel like Sheena said, as our world becomes more complicated, and, you know, if we're not asking the right questions, and we're not, if we all just fall asleep and just assume that things are being taken care of, I just feel like we're on a really bad path. And I think people need to stop assuming that government and these agencies are going to take care of them, and I feel like people need to take more responsibility on themselves to find out if there is, you know, is your environment negatively impacting you? Is the food you eat negatively impacting you? Take responsibility, because I feel like what somebody said in the Q&A the other day that they really liked in the film as well is that it's not, you know, as much as we're being critical of the industry, it's not all the industry's fault. You know, we have responsibility too. You know, we have a say in these things. And the more that we don't ask questions and the more that we don't speak up, industry's going to do what industry does. They're going to put these places, they're going to build these plants, and they're counting on people not being informed, and they're counting on people not rising up. And that makes it really easy for them. So I think that we have to be more accountable, is I guess the bottom line. If we want things to change, if we want things to get better, I just feel like we have to have a voice.
And just one thing I'll add, as far as energy goes, you know, we need to take a look at our consumption. No one really likes to talk too much about conservation when discussing our energy needs and our energy appetite, but certainly that's something that every individual can take responsibility for and try and maybe lessen their impact a little bit.
We really don't have solutions in this country that are sacrificial. You know, we don't, when it comes right down to it, it's like, well, we need more power because more people want power. And we need to start having that conversation because, you know, uranium is not a infinite resource. Oil is not an infinite resource, you know. So these things are going to go away at a certain point in time. And we need to be thinking now, you know, how we're going to manage, you know, for the next 100 years if we're around that long. Because if we're not asking those questions now, that we live in a culture that is just take, 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 take. And, you know, when it comes right down to it, those are going to be the things that when there is no food left or there is no oil left and there is no, you know, uranium left, then what? You know, we can't wait till it's all gone before we come up with a solution. But I fear that's the kind of culture we are. You know, we're a crisis only. We deal with things when it's a crisis level. We don't deal with things in a preventative way.
The film is a timely and unwitting reminder of the proposed Green River nuclear power plant in Utah.
In making this film, my eyes are now open to nuclear issues in the news in this country every week. And I am surprised by how often it is in the news and how little mainstream attention from the press that it gets. And so I think and I hope that people will watch this film and their eyes will be open also, and they'll start seeing, you know, more nuclear in the news all around them, and, you know, just start paying attention and asking some tough questions. But I think water rights will continue to be a big issue. I think, you know, there was recently the Vermont Yankee federal decision in the news. I think that sets precedent for what's going to happen at Indian Point this summer. So it's going on all around us. It's not just here in Utah.
That was Don Argott and Sheena Joyce, directors of the 2012 documentary film Atomic States of America. Sherry Quinn, Access Utah. If you can, is there anybody's children can tell me? Tell me, what is the soul of a man? Won't somebody tell me? Answer if you can. I want somebody to tell me. Tell me, what is the soul? Countries. I traveled to the furthest lands, couldn't find nobody could tell me. Tell me, what about the soul of a man? Won't somebody tell me? Answer if you can. I want somebody to tell me. Tell me, what is the soul?
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. I'm Megan Van Frank. Ever wonder about the giant eye on the mountainside above Brigham City? This week, learn what that letter stands for. First this.
The Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by the Utah Humanities Council, with support from a We the People grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation.
The eye is fading fast on the mountainside above Brigham City, Utah. Winter snows threaten to erase it for good, and with it, the memory of one of Utah's more significant stories, the Intermountain Indian School, a federally run Native American boarding school. The Intermountain Indian School opened its doors in January 1950 on the site of the old Bushnell General Military Hospital. The school served students from the Navajo Reservation, covering southern Utah, Arizona, and New Mexico. In the early 1950s, many Navajo children had difficulty reading, writing, and speaking English. Instead of building new schools on the reservation, policymakers sent students to vocational boarding schools like the one in Brigham City. Tribal leaders initially went along with the plan because it seemed the only way their children could get an education. During its peak years, enrollment at Intermountain Indian School topped 2,300 students, making it one of the largest Indian boarding schools in the United States. One of the school's teachers, Claire Olson, recalls that each year the school scheduled with Greyhound Bus Company for pickup points on the reservation. the parents would stand off a distance from the loading area. The school worked to assimilate Navajo children into the dominant American culture. Students had to speak English and adopt the hairstyles, dress, and social patterns of other American teenagers. In addition to regular academic subjects, students learned a vocation, preparing them for entry-level employment. Classes were drawn along gender lines. Boys learned welding, auto mechanics, and painting, while girls took classes in homemaking, cooking, and sewing. In some ways, the boarding school system succeeded in unanticipated ways. It produced a new generation of Native Americans ready to challenge government programs and policies. In 1973, Navajo leaders pushed to educate their children closer to home. The Intermountain Indian School remained open by accepting students from other tribes, but ultimately closed its doors in 1984. Research and writing for this episode of the Beehive Archive were provided by Rebecca Anderson. Sources and past episodes may be found at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of the Utah Humanities Council, I'm Megan Van Frank.
Hi, this is Blair Larson, host of Fresh Folk. On the show this week, I featured the 12th album from the talented Indigo Girls and the appreciation-themed new release from Stephen Kellogg and the Sixers. I'll also play songs from new albums by Sophie Carpenter, Annie Crane, and Aaron White, among other talented artists. Join me this Saturday at 8 p.m. for Fresh Folk on Utah Public Radio.
Coming up on the next Bluegrass Breakdown, he's a singer, hit songwriter, bassist, and drummer. He's played with the Limelighters, Freddie Fender, Mason Williams, California, Sawmill Road, and Dan Carreri. He's appeared in HBO's hit series Deadwood and has generally made the acoustic world a better place. I'm Dave Higgs, and Steve Spurgeon will be our special live guest on the next Bluegrass Breakdown.
Saturday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Support for Science Questions comes from the College of Science at Utah State University, where students step beyond the classroom, participating in advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. For more information, visit usu.edu/science.
All right, everybody. Ha, 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 ho, 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 he, 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 ha, 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 ho, 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 he, 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 ha, 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 ho, 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 he, 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 ha, 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 ho, 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 he, 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 ha, 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 ha,
ha, ha, ha, ha, ha, Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Susie Montgomery.
And I'm Sherry Quinn.
So does everybody feel a little better now?
You just heard a laughing class put on by a group called Fresh Start, an organization overseen by Valley Mental Health. That was how the class, Happiness 101, started. And Ralph teaches about a dozen psychiatric patients twice a week how laughter is the best medicine. Valley Mental Health manages almost all mental health care across Salt Lake, Tooele, and Summit counties, from people with serious mental illnesses like schizophrenia and bipolar patients, to people with substance abuse disorders and behavioral problems like obsessive compulsive disorder and depression.
Valley Mental Health has been the major and almost only mental health care provider across the Wasatch Front for the past 2 decades. It was this not-for-profit entity that held the Medicaid contract issued by the state of Utah, who prepaid them yearly to assess, manage, and distribute basically all the funds allocated to helping the mentally ill. And they were recently dethroned by a multi-billion-dollar health insurance company called United Health Group, who manages a subsidiary called Optum, who now calls the shots. In a 2-part series, SQ Radio reports on what's being referred to as a crisis in mental health care. It started at the end of 2011 and is still a rough transition because Valley Mental Health was a Goliath that no one thought would ever fall.
Many of the folks that won't be with us after the first of the year have been with us for many years.
Valley Mental Health has announced the layoffs of up to 125 employees. How will that affect the services the agency provides? Good evening. Valley Mental Health employees whose jobs will be cut will find out December 1st. Their last day on the payroll will be December 31st.
The news comes with the announcement of a major reconfiguration of how people will be treated by the agency. Sarah Dolliff is live in Salt Lake with the details. Sarah, what's going on?
Well, Bruce and Deanie, what do you do when you provide a critical service to the community yet are looking at less and less funding? Well, Valley Mental Health is changing the way it provides treatment services. It hopes this will mean continued service for its patient load of 20,000 people. But if the funding doesn't pick up anytime soon, they say more cuts will have to be made.
We're facing an impending sort of tragic situation for a lot of patients.
That is clinical psychiatrist Dr. Noel Gardner. He recently resigned from Valley Mental Health, along with a large number of his fellow clinicians who have also left in the last several months. He explains why.
The centerpiece of that process was a deep sense of responsibility for patients who are highly vulnerable, and also a strong sense of camaraderie with our colleagues, nurses, social workers, therapists, caseworkers, that we work as a team trying to provide these services. And it felt like abandoning people you care deeply about. So, you know, I think many of us stayed long beyond the time we felt that it was healthy or good for us to do.
Dr. Gardner says the deal breaker was the micromanagement of the encounters the clinicians had with their patients, where administrators prioritized mass production efficiency rather than putting the patient first.
It began to feel like every person was simply a source of information to be generated into the electronic record. And increasingly, we were told that we had to see more and more patients in less and less time with more and more data collection, to the point that 80-85% of our time was computer FaceTime, and 10-15-20% of our time was patient face-to-face time.
And the computer work was stacking up.
And what was so sad for us was that it wasn't very useful information. It felt like we were simply generating documentation to make it appear like we were providing the care, when in fact the care itself, we were providing some of it, but it was so drained of the personal element that is essential to good quality care that it felt meaningless to do it. Now, I understand that people felt the obligation to bring these to bear. There were requirements for reporting certain things, but the whole bureaucratic attempt to bring efficiencies the process had become so removed from the clinical reality that what we were doing no longer made sense. And it felt like there was huge liability. That is, we were not adequately able to engage the patient, get sufficient information to feel confident in the decision-making necessary within the timeframes that were being required, that it felt like we were carrying the medical legal liability for people in decision making, that we just simply didn't have the time to make good decisions and still meet all the requirements that were being placed upon us.
All the other kids better run, 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 run back to the shadow.
I am walking into a downtown Salt Lake City pharmacy with who we are calling BH. He's an old friend and who wishes to remain anonymous and is currently a patient at Valley Mental Health.
I need to pick up the refill.
Well, I'm picking up antipsychotic medication because it's the same Walgreens that I pick up my antipsychotic medication from Valley Mental Health.
And what's your experience been like with Valley Mental Health?
Well, they're somewhat accommodating. My therapist came downstairs because I wasn't able to climb upstairs, even though his office was upstairs. But they don't have any psychiatrists that I get to see, so it's an RN that prescribes my medication for me. The RN was just, you know, going through the different possible antipsychotic medications, and he basically let me pick what medication I wanted, because the previous antipsychotic medication had my legs kicking. I was having spasms, and originally picked, I think it was Abilify for me. This is the one I had the problem with, and I just recently chose olanzapine as my drug of choice. I've had a psychologist that's a licensed psychologist, but I've never seen a psychiatrist at all at Valley Mental Health.
Do you find it takes longer now to get appointments, prescriptions, anything like that?
I don't think it really takes longer to get those things. I mean, they schedule everything. It's just that the access to a psychiatrist is impossible. I feel like I'm getting less care than maybe what I need. So that's a little sad. And, you know, I guess the times to get in to see a psychologist are fewer and more far between. I was told that I couldn't see one anyway if I wanted to. And that's a bit of a bummer. I don't know. I mean, the therapist was a good therapist, but it just seemed like he was running out of advice to give. When he ran out of it, he just kind of kept reiterating what he was saying before. So, I don't know. I grade the whole thing at, you know, a C-minus experience, but I don't really have any other locations to compare it with. All the other kids with the phone.
So it's not so much that I feel like these are bad people. I think their intentions were good. But mental health treatment is a very personal thing. And it takes time, and it takes relationship, and it takes communication. And it felt like we had begun to exist for the purpose of generating documentation, for the purpose of billing, and that the patients were really grist for that, rather than that the entire administration was in the service of providing us the opportunity to do sufficient care, personal care, that was really quality for the patients. In many ways, healthcare has been hijacked, in a sense, by a set of sort of corporate, and it's not just sort of profit or cost savings. It is this idea that quality care will do sort of the exact same thing with every patient. Now, if you're building Toyotas, you want to have very precise, consistent systems so that those cars are put together in a very precise, exactly the same way every time, so they come off with this kind of perfection. The problem is, when you're dealing with people, every person is unique. I mean, and it's we're not treating diseases, we're treating persons. And even if they share the same diagnosis, that diagnosis is completely a different entity in one individual than it is in another. And the kind of relationship you form takes unique personal skills to make that therapeutic experience work. It takes trusting the clinician to do the work. We need to reclaim a sense of the professional trust. That is, these are people who are trained with extensive clinical experience to do this kind of work. Now we need to trust them to do that, rather than to try to micromanage every bit of the data, every bit of the processes, to turn people into Toyotas coming off an assembly line so that we can bill for that chunk of service, collect the revenue. There is this kind of delusional thinking that somehow that is quality improvement in healthcare, and it's not quality improvement.
At at the pharmacy called Apothecary, where the main clientele are patients with behavioral health disorders on Medicaid. Pharmacist and owner Kevin DeMoss is dispensing drugs the new way.
This is an AutoMed fast fill automatic dispensing system. And then it's just like a great big battleship game, like I-9 and A-4. And then it tells us where their prescription's going to fall out of.
DeMoss is upset. He sees patients every day coming in, unable to fill their prescriptions because now they can't get in fast enough to see their doctors. Doctors who are overwhelmed, stretched thin, because of major cutbacks, and now Optum, who's taken over the contract, has a very different management style, throwing yet another curveball into the field.
Patients establish a relationship with their caregiver, whether it's their medical doctor, their psychiatrist, their psychologist, their nurse, their rep payee, their therapist, their social worker, their dentist, their pharmacist. Each one of these patients who deliver that service, that fee for service, there's a relationship developed between that patient and that provider, all the way down to the pharmacy. And then when that is eliminated or disrupted in any way, oftentimes the patients are going to find another provider if they're able. They're going to find another provider that they're comfortable with, that they can share their intimacies with, that they can share their fears with, and their anxieties or their aggressions or their feelings. It's very difficult to go in and establish that visit after visit after visit with a new provider, with someone you've never seen before. They're the most timid, they're the most vulnerable of any of the patient populations that we deal with. They're the less stable of all, and they need the most care. That's why it's so critical that they can have that relationship with their provider, because it helps them to maintain the dignity and their operating level that they've been accustomed to. Every day, we talk about it all day long. Where are you at? How's your anxiety? How's your aggression? How are you doing with your agitation? Are you taking your meds? Are you taking them with food? Are you taking them at night? We go through and we plan every patient's medication management system for them so that they can have the very, very best outcome. And then when I don't see my patients, they're left to do it on their own, and they can't.
This has been happening in healthcare, all of healthcare, for the last couple of decades. So it's not unique to mental health or to Valley. I think it was accelerated by the coming Optum contract and the implications of it. And internally, Valley tried to accommodate to those expected sort of changes with strategies that have made it harder and harder for clinicians to do their work. Increasingly, and that's what happened in my world, I found myself with doctors and advanced practice nurses having left. These people who are on antipsychotic medications need their medications refilled. I have no place to put them in my schedule. I already have my patient load. So I'm signing off refills of medications for large numbers of people who I've never seen, which we're always told don't be prescribing and managing people you've never examined and know nothing about.
Basically, there's nothing for my symptoms. If I have symptoms or I feel like I'm having an episode, I can call and arrange an appointment. But that's anywhere from, 4 days to a few weeks out to see anyone. And so it's not an emergency room style operation. And that's just to see my psychiatrist. But I mean, I could always arrange to go see the guy again, because he only is giving me 5 minutes of his time before he's prescribing me pills. So I think the pressure's on him to push people through like a cattle farm.
This is a crisis point. We need to sit down and rethink where we're at, because just simply acting like everything is normal is not going to solve a problem that is waiting for a major tragedy.
Pharmacist DeMoss recalls one of these critical incidents where he witnessed one of his female patients in his pharmacy heading down that volatile path.
So she came in and talked to me on a Saturday, and she was very, very concerned that she was going to run out of her medication before her doctor's appointment. And she knew that in the back of her mind that was going to precipitate an emergency room visit and possibly a hospital an admit for her. So if she was left without this very important medication for the 5 to 7 day gap before she got in to see her doctor, she knew in her heart and in her mind that she was convinced that she would relapse and end up in the hospital.
And consequences in the emergency room at the University of Utah Hospital are also apparent to Dr. Troy Madsen, Research Director in Emergency Medicine.
I definitely have seen an increase in the number of patients we see with psychiatric issues or psychiatric complaints. That's been my experience, and it also is supported by looking at some of the numbers over the last few years, where it has increased over the last couple of years by about, maybe about 7%. In terms of the psychiatric patients, they make up about probably 7 or 8% of the patients that we do see in the ER. So it's a pretty good chunk when you figure one out of, every 10 or 15 patients you see is going to be there for some kind of a psychiatric reason. That may be in part because we do work closely with UNI, with the University Neuropsychiatric Institute. And so we do a lot of kind of working with them, screening patients for them. I think that's probably a big contributor to the large percentage of psychiatric patients we see. But I have definitely seen those numbers go up in the last few years.
It seems that this healthcare crisis has a tremendous ripple effect, overflowing into our streets and infiltrating our social programs, hospitals, and even the jails.
We need a mechanism for rethinking mental health care in which the severe, persistent mentally ill are the first priority, and that we take care of that population. If we don't, many of them will become homeless. They'll be in jails because they often unintentionally commit crimes. They're caught loitering, breaking and entering. Sometimes they will become paranoid and commit serious crimes. And I do a fair amount of forensic expert witness work on criminal cases. It's a great tragedy that these people end up often in the criminal justice world.
We used to always talk about how the biggest psychiatric hospital in the state is in the jail and the prison. Basically, little psychiatric hospitals inside of all the jails and prisons in every county in this state and around the country.
That was Trent Holmberg, the former director of psychiatric services at Salt Lake County Jail, who now has a private practice as a psychiatrist. The job at the jail just got too tough.
When we do treat people once they're incarcerated, it's kind of with a half-hearted effort in terms of the financial support to back that kind of an effort, because it's a Herculean task to treat, hundreds of thousands of mentally ill people in jails and prisons around the country.
And it is really expensive to buy the necessary drugs for these patients, roughly $50,000 per month, and that's bare bones for these highly specialized drugs.
It's really reaping what was sown a few generations ago when the insane asylums became state hospitals, and the state hospitals became criticized as being a place to warehouse mentally ill people.
I am amazed at how few people really understand the history of community mental health and the history of the development of psychiatry, including the top leadership of each of these organizations, who I think largely have sort of accepted the way things are and don't always fully appreciate sort of the context. So let me just say a couple of things that are essential to understand. Community mental health is a product of some things that happened way back over 50, 60 years ago. That is, prior to about the early 1960s, mid-50s, early 60s, psychiatric care for this population was done in state hospitals. These are people for whom there was no treatment. The very first antipsychotic medication that allowed the quieting of all of these hallucinations and voices and the severe agitation, the very first antipsychotic became available in the United States in 1954. Prior to that, these people were housed often in state hospitals that had anywhere from 1,200 to sometimes 10,000, 12,000 patients in one state hospital on huge, sprawling compounds. And there was really no treatment for these people other than to keep them housed and clean and safe and fed, which was a very valuable service to people otherwise who would have been homeless. What this new treatment did is allowed moving those people into the community, and there was a large government action to establish community mental health centers in the community that allowed us to treat and maintain these people in the community. Now, that is how it was established, and that was really the primary investment in the precursors, the organizations, community mental health systems that were here before Valley Mental Health. And these were largely government agencies. Some states do it as a state phenomenon. Here we've done it primarily administered through counties. But the commitment was to this very severe, persistent, chronic, disabling mental illness.
What then happened was the government enacted Medicaid, and it became entitlement insurance, providing mental health care to anybody who qualified based on their financial situations. The working poor, and many who were not working, qualified for Medicaid and were entitled to these services. More and more people who did not have serious mental illnesses then began to flood the system.
And in many ways, overwhelmed it, often with people who had emotional difficulties because they had horrific, difficult, challenging lives, but weren't really people who had clearly defined mental illnesses that were readily treated by sort of the sort of kind of standard effective mental health treatments we had for serious mental illness. That is a context that is never discussed.
Yeah.
And it is one of the foundational issues that must be addressed and are not being addressed.
The cost of providing government-based insurance like Medicaid became a more crucial issue, increasing pressure on bureaucratic leadership at the county, state, and federal levels to try to drive efficiency into that system. They began to micromanage every aspect, requiring loads of documentation expected faster and faster.
So increasingly, we were treating people who were not the sickest people, for whom our treatments had only a modest degree of benefit, even though they may have some benefit. And as a clinician, you take each patient and their pain and their difficulty and do whatever you can to try to help them. But in the process, began to squeeze out more and more the needs of people who had no real capacity to function in the community without not only medication, but a whole set of support services to maintain them in the community. And this really, then, is the fundamental crisis.
I was horrified that day.
This is the rest of the story of Kevin DeMoss's patient, who ran out of her medication and had to go to the emergency room.
As I thought about that and as I processed that information after she left, I thought to myself, what is happening to our system? Where are those services that we fund? These are taxpayer dollars that the county has. What's happening to those services? Why do these patients have to come and suffer and can't get access to health care that they deserve and that they've had? The providers have been cut, but the patients haven't been cut. We still have the same patient population and same patient load that we've had for years and years and years, but the availability of services for these patients has diminished greatly. I do not know where the money has gone. I see management with lots of money. I see decision makers that are doing very, very well. And then I see my patients who have to sit in the pharmacy for extended periods of time just to process the information on the cutbacks that they are having to deal with. But I only see the cutbacks on a patient level. I don't see those on a management level.
It's the wrong system. They may be very nice people. I've met people in this, and I think they're nice, well-meaning people, but it is the wrong construct for this population. I also think the Valley Mental Health has not adapted to it well, and we need a mechanism for rethinking mental health care in which the severe, persistent mentally ill are the first priority.
Optum has taken over the state Medicaid contract and is now overseeing Valley Mental Health. Next week, in part two of this story, we will hear from Optum and their proposed changes to the mental health care system, and explore how all the players, like Tim Whalen, foresee the treatment and quality of life for Utah's psychiatric patients.
First and foremost, they want to do what's right for the folks that are suffering with mental illness and addiction disorders, but secondarily, it helps us to avoid unnecessary costs in the jail and incarcerating folks in the jail that really they're only there as a result of their mental illness.
Thank you for listening.
Science Questions produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery.
Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour, we'll explore the danceable, lilting music that falls under the umbrella of Afropop. Music that fuses African traditions with Western rock, pop, blues, and jazz. I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join me for Afropop, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Friday night at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Did you know that by repeatedly tasting fruits and vegetables, children can increase their liking of these foods? To accomplish this, parents should supply a fruit and a vegetable at lunch and dinner. Small incentives are a good way to promote initial and repeated tasting of these foods. As your child learns to enjoy fruits and vegetables, the incentives become unnecessary. Make it fun and you will make a difference in your child's food choices.
Did You Know That is made possible by the USU Emma Eccles Jones College of Education and Human Services. More at ces.usu.edu.